Hello there, I'm Eamon Holmes, and this is my podcast series where I sit down in one of the country's finest pubs for a pint and a chat with some of the most legendary names in football. Now, this week, I came to The Gun in Spitalfields, East London, to meet one of the game's most innovative thinkers, Mr. Sam Allardyce. Sam, of course, is also one of football's biggest characters, and as always, he had a lot to say.
And then on top of that, they sold Lukaku to Manchester United. You can feel a good dressing room and you can feel a bad one. And of course, the time it took them to sort it out, we felt at the time and still do, that was negligent. And the only thing that saved me in the end was Steve Parish and ringing me up and saying, please come and help Crystal Palace out. I think Juffy did it once and it cost him a few bob, that did.
All that and much more to come. And a little word about the pub that we met in. It's called The Gun. It's a stone's throw away from the Square Mile in London. And it's within view of the historic Spitalfields Market. A pub's actually been on this site since the 17th century. And it was just the place to have a good chat with Big Sam. I hope you enjoy listening to it.
And once Sam Allardyce launches himself into one of those, it's going to be a goal.
The terminology you associate with Sam is a survivor. He can survive with whichever club he's with in terms of make sure they don't get relegated. But there's a bit more to Sam than that.
Yes, Sam! Give the man the credit he deserves! Sam Allardyce!
Cheers, mate.
And in comes Allardyce!
Sam Allardyce is one of the most successful and charismatic English managers of his generation. He started his playing career at non-league Dudley Town before moving to Bolton Wanderers, where he formed one half of a fearsome centre-back partnership with Paul Jones. He then went on to play for a number of other clubs, including Coventry, Millwall and Preston. As his playing career was winding down, he took on a player coaching role at West Brom, before going on to be player-manager at Limerick in the Republic of Ireland, and then Preston in the early 90s. After spells as manager at Blackpool and Notts County, it wasn't until taking over Bolton Wanderers and guiding them into the Premier League for the 2001 season that he came to national attention. While at the Trotters, he developed a reputation for embracing sports science and for getting the best out of players in the twilight of their careers, such as Youri Djorkaeff and JJ Okocha. And then after leaving Bolton in 2007, Big Sam went on to manage Newcastle, West Ham, Sunderland, Crystal Palace and Everton. And then, of course, there was that short and very ill-fated spell as England manager. Sam, I'm sitting here, and cheers incidentally, and I'm seeing you calm, relaxed. It's as if you're 10 years younger.
Well, that's what everybody else tells me. So they say, "Why, Sam, you're looking well." And it must have an effect, obviously, because the strains and stresses of a manager continue to grow more and more in the Premier League, particularly on the size of the money. And the money's become that big that there's more and more strain on everybody, particularly the manager, to bring that instant success, and that's very difficult to achieve in today's modern game because of the way you have to go around trying to find players at enormous prices and enormous salaries. And I think that the industry has to continue to grow its recruitment policies beyond its biggest department, really, because the recruitment department determines your success level.
So you're not one of those guys that would say, right, I'm the manager, I'll make the signings. But the way you're talking, you're not anti-director of football?
No, I'm not anti-director of football, but I'm also not in the position where the relationship between the recruitment department, the analysis, now the algorithms, where there's a lot of clubs are employing the technical side in terms of putting in data for churning out the variable probability of what this player could maybe do or not do. But what that tends or is tending to override at the top end of our game and our bosses is why do we need this scouting as much? Why do we need all these men travelling the world watching these players? Well, the actual fact of the matter is, if you don't do that, you don't see the character of the player. You need eyes on the ground and eyes watching. And if you put the two together, along with the technical and physical stats, then you come to a better decision. And then the argument would be, then, who fancies who the most? Does the director of football fancy that one more than you do, or you fancy that one more than he does? The stats will come in, but then if you've got your scouting department and you sit down, you make that decision, and you make that decision and you roll with it. You don't, as a manager, always get your way. That's that you can accept that, but your success or failure is going to depend on the recruitment of those players. And I will verify that by the fact that, as you know, at this stage, I've managed to save a number of clubs from relegation, and in particular the Sunderland, Blackburn Rovers, Crystal Palace. And I think that was all around our recruitment policy in January, when we were desperate for new players to freshen up the team that was struggling, was maybe in the bottom four or five of the Premier League, and you needed to refresh the playing staff, and you need to find better players than you already had.
Yeah.
Now, there's lots of stuff that help you in making those decisions. And as a manager today, you cannot fly all over the world and watch these players yourself, as used to be deemed by the old managers. But you can sit down and watch a player's clips now because of the technology. So you can watch, if you want a better defender, you can put the defender's name in, and his last six games will come up where there'll be 10 or 15 minutes of what he's done in that game on defending,
yeah,
or 5 or 10 minutes on how he's attacked or what his passing's like. And you can make a decision, as well as what your recruitment department and what the stats say, and say, well, he looks like he could fit in for us, and he is what we need at this moment in time. And I think that that is a very important decision that's to be made by anybody. And certainly the most important decision is not panicking.
Okay, you say that's what we need this moment in time. Then you get a chief executive that says, no, what we need is a younger player whose value will grow. You may say, no, I want someone at, say, 30 years of age who's going to bring a lot of experience just for this season, which brings me to this whole thing, age versus experience.
Residual value is always very important for a chief executive or a director of football, because they want to see the value increase on the books. But I would also say this, the value of what you have in the Premier League is around, even with the smallest club, about 160 million turnover today. So you finish fourth and bottom, I think it's a minimum guarantee of 115 million. You put your sponsorship, your season tickets, your sales, your corporate hospitality on top of that, you're talking maybe 160 million and more. And so by a younger player that's not ready now wouldn't fit into that category in terms of saving your Premier League status. And saving the Premier League status is getting that player now who may in a year or two's time you let go, but his value is that he's kept you in the Premier League for one and two seasons.
And where do you go for them, Sam? Because the Leicesters of this world don't have to sell anymore. The Villas of this world don't have to sell anymore. Wolves don't have to sell anymore. No one really has to sell anymore because of the Premier League and the money it makes around the world.
Yes, because selling becomes a market that you, if you sell in that market, you have to buy in that market.
Yeah.
And of course, if you sell for £150 million, then everybody knows you've sold for £150 million. Players that you had in your list that you might have got for £30 million, say, all of a sudden become £70
million, right,
because they've seen that your income has increased by the sale of that player. And by, of course, at Everton, for instance, Farad's introduction of much more money than Everton has ever had for many, many years under Bill Kenwright inflated nearly, you know, all the prices that they went for. And then on top of that, they sold Lukaku to Manchester United.
So here's the situation, and this is where it gets personal. Everton, you were there, you were at the helm, a new proprietor, money was coming into the club, a new stadium, all of these things, and then it doesn't work out. Now, here's my point. Everybody has an opinion about Sam Allardyce and what sort of manager he is. How would you describe yourself as a manager?
Well, I would say my idea of working my way up to initially getting the club that I've loved, and since it gave me the opportunity to play football at Bolton Wanderers, was to put into place finally the thoughts that I had to take the game forward and find out whether some different sides of technology and academic skills would work in football on the basis of moving the game forward. So 1999 would be the introduction of Prozone into Bolton Wanderers, which was one of the big pieces of technology about the whole game plan of your team on how it played, and you got that information. Now, we had to break down all that data to find out how useful it was and how we could use it. And I think that the department had to grow on the basis that we'd limited budget, and then we went to find a staff that would grow the team and find the player to fit our solutions. So sports science, psychology, fitness, nutrition, whatever that area was needed to be changed, had to be changed by an expert in that field. So my idea was that to find somebody who was an expert in that field, employ them into the club, gave them the responsibility for their department, and move on. Now then came a high quality player. So the high quality players that we eventually found at Bolton would bring that club and take that club forward to a very, very high level. Unfortunately, my biggest fault was allowing the press and some other managers to criticise our tactics. And instead of nailing that on the head straight away and say, what is this all about? What is this jealousy about that we can beat Arsenal, or we can beat Chelsea, or we can beat Manchester United? Why is this criticism at us?
Well, they would have said at the time it's because you were long ball merchants. So, however you were doing it, you were punching above your weight. The long ball accusation, what would you say?
I should have nailed it then, but didn't, and thought, well, you know, effectively, in a pragmatic point of view, you have to deeply look into your players and what suits them. And this is why managing seven Premier League clubs now has given me the opportunity to manage seven Premier League clubs, because whatever happened at Bolton didn't happen at Newcastle, or didn't happen at Blackburn. Whatever happened at didn't happen at Blackburn, and Blackburn to Crystal Palace and to Sunderland and to West Ham, because it was different cultures at different football clubs and different opportunities that the owners would say, what do you want me to do? But because I never shook that tactic or that label.
Yes.
And once as you well know,
yes,
once the label is there, it sticks. And you can't eventually or have to worry about that. But it does have a bearing effect on the people continuing to say it who doesn't really know you or are not involved in what you do or how you do it.
But what they do know about you, whether you like it or not, is that if they are in trouble, you are the man on speed dial. Isn't it then a sort of badge of honour to be known as chief firefighter?
Or troubleshooter. Yeah. I think that label has obviously stuck in recent years, and that's exactly what I've been. I've taken myself into a situation that's difficult at that particular time. But I've got the experience to not panic when everybody else is panicking around.
Yeah, yes.
To keep a level head, and that's come by various members of staff that I would take with me, and the calming of a very difficult situation that you go into, and having to make some very, very quick decisions to turn the fortunes of the club around. That's not just on the field, that's off the field as well. So you go through the process of making a whole sweep of what is happening at the football club, and have a great communication, and I talk about this an awful lot, with the owner or your chief executive or your director of football, whatever it might be, because without that relationship, you can't get your players that you want. You can't go and pull in the right direction. So we talk a lot about coaching and a lot about what we do for players and what staff do for them. But you've also got to be able to communicate at that level or up a level onto their level to actually try and persuade them into your way of thinking. Because ultimately, they all have their own opinion, but you've been employed as the expert in football. And you have got to give and be stronger at giving your opinion and say, if you want to succeed or and you want to get out of trouble in the latter years, then we must actually try and improve this position, that position.
As a player and a manager, what a career would you put it all together? And at Bolton, they used to call you Super Sam Bionic Man, didn't they?
I know, yeah. I mean, that's an honour, wasn't it? Like, you mean, you got the south centre half that the fans love. You know, and sing your name. I mean, that's supposed to be only one Frankie Worthington, or Peter Thompson, or, you know, it's Nora at the front end. But it, I don't know, it must have just been the way I played and the way they see me play, you know, the tough tackling centre-half at the time, the committed player with limited ability. You know, I could see when I arrived at the football club that if I was to make a first team player that I would maximise what my strengths would be. And I think that even though I didn't know it then, I think at my early age the asking of coaches of what can you do to help me, and then them to ask me, well, what do you think your strengths are, and they would agree or disagree, and I'd say, well, let's work at the weaknesses. And actually at that same period in time, and say, no, well, let's work on your strengths and make them better, because that's what's going to make you a footballer. So it was a bit of a different opinion to what you hear about a lot about, he needs to work at this, he's not so good at that, whereas the opposite of that for me was, you need to make that better. That doesn't mean to say you don't try and improve your weaknesses, you do, but you maximise your strengths first, and that's effectively what made me a footballer at the time.
Because of that journey that you took, because of all those teams that you played for, because of all the managers you played under, it must have rubbed off, the good and the bad. As fans, we all think we could manage. We all think we could make the hard decisions, who to buy, who to sell, who not to select. But you actually have got to do it in real life. You've got to look a lad in the eye and say, I'm selling you, I'm dropping you, whatever it happens to be. What are you like to work for?
I have to have, in my career, a lot of managers are my huge respect and would run through a brick wall for them, you know what I mean, on the basis of just how they day-to-day manage not just me, but the whole team. And then there were some managers that weren't quite as good at that and didn't, probably in the end, and it's probably my fault really, they didn't quite get as much out of me as maybe other managers did. They didn't operate in that manner where it would create a sort of a good dressing room. You can feel a good dressing room and you can feel a bad one, you know, and then when that feeling is a good, then I think players actually go and play above themselves and ride this crest of a wave for a period of time, and then as a manager you must always look to the future and see what can be improved, and you can never rest on your laurels and think that success is going to continue without you planning ahead. And that's one of the big problems with football at the moment. It always seems it's all about this season and nothing else, and then the season after, not the 3, 4 and 5 year future of a football club. That seems to have gone lost or got lost. Even at Manchester United at this moment in time, it's all about getting them back now. But, you know, where is it going to lie? Who is going to come in the next 2 years or 3 years, which Liverpool before Manchester United were always particularly good at? And I have to say at this moment in time, probably Manchester City and Liverpool again.
Right. As a player, as a manager, you've got to have an ego or else what's the point of doing it? Then something like the Manchester United job comes up for grabs. And, you know, if you have got any ego at all, you must think, I could be in with a shout with this, I could do this. But then it goes to David Moyes. Nothing against David Moyes, but, I mean, how do you feel, how did you feel when you were bypassed?
I can't quite remember which club I was at that time. Shows you how many clubs I've had now. That's it. If you've got anything about yourself as a manager, we all strive to move up the ranks. And the initial ambition was to manage in the Premier League for me. And then if you're in the Premier League, you know, is it possible that you may eventually get a top six or top four football club, which is one of the hardest achievements you can make, I think, in today's modern game in the Premier League. It all seems to favour... I've got nothing against the foreign coaches at all whatsoever. They make us work better, make us strive harder. But they're all taken, apart from Frank Lampard now, they're all taken by foreign coaches. But to be in a position of being hugely successful at that time is about that opportunity coming, and then they maybe consider you because you're doing so well at that particular club you're at the moment. But if that overlooks you, you can't dwell on that. You just keep it going along and enjoying being a manager, because if you don't enjoy it, you shouldn't be in it. And whatever the stresses or strains and there are, it's the day-to-day working with the players and the difficulties that come along with it, and overcoming those difficulties, and then watching the team grow and watching you build a team, and that team going out representing you to try and be as successful as possible for the fans, and the success and the cheers and the oohs and ahs. So we hear the criticism, yes, but we also hear the applause and the praise, which we all like. But you, in the middle of that, either way, you learn to keep a level head. So when you get there, you don't get carried away. When you're down here, you don't go down there, and you stay on the level playing field.
You say going down there, and you couldn't have gone down any further than when the England job came along. There you go, one game, 100% record, and then that entrapment comes along. The Telegraph said you didn't break any rules. The FA said you didn't break any rules. And you're out of a job as a result. How disappointed. You say you don't let yourself get down, but you must have felt robbed, basically. You must have felt mugged, like someone stole from you.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I think there's I don't know whether you've recently heard Scott McGarvey, who's actually eventually come out, who was the guy that I knew that I went along to help at the time. He did an article in the Mail and did an hour on Talk Sport and gave the full facts and version again, which obviously, you know, gives people more of an understanding, just, I think, how the decision was made so quickly by the FA that you wonder why did they come to that particular decision that quickly.
They came to the decision. It wasn't you.
No, they said I can't carry on. And if I'd done that much wrong, and I look back now, and I was in a cloud at the time, and I wasn't allowed any representation. That was a real thing for me in terms of that institution not allowing you the opportunity, basically, to defend yourself. So it was, done and dusted in a few hours, and when I look back on the fact that I was just coming from, with very little sleep, coming from home back down to the FA, sitting and talking to him for an hour, and then sat in a room where he just made that decision, and if I had my time over again, I would have probably done it different, but that has happened. But why they come to that decision has never really been explained to me. But I can only consider that it was panic on their behalf, on what they thought it had, in terms of damage their reputation. But clearly, as time wore on, and the euphoria that the amount of negative publicity and what people were saying about me and about the FA wasn't true. And of course, if I'd have done that much wrong, why'd they pay me off? So I don't really know why they did it. Only they can tell you that, but it did happen. And the only thing that saved me in the end was Steve Parish. I was ringing me up and saying, please come and help Crystal Palace out. And that really was the time I could bury it into the subconscious and never forget about it, but put it away. And that release by come and do what you're good at, come and manage our football club.
And how did the fans receive you at that time?
Oh, they were brilliant. Fabulous. I think the Palace fans have been fabulous with every manager, believe you me. I mean, they're one of a kind. And I think the fans understand, the Crystal Palace fans understand what their football club is and don't live above the expectation. They don't expect to be finishing in Europe.
But what do you expect now? If it was me, I'd trust people less. Maybe you thought that was you finished with football. You must be less trusting and a more cynical human being as a result.
Well, you have to be as a human being when that's happened to you. And of course, one of the real disappointing things is that at that particular stage was the I had this unbelievable lawyer, and without him, I couldn't have cleared this situation up. But he was the genius that went to Ipswich and said they'll have to sort it out. And of course, the time it took them to sort it out, we felt at the time and still do, that was negligent. That they should have come to the conclusion a lot quicker and been a lot more severe on what they made actually the Telegraph do, because they were the ones that actually made the Telegraph write the retraction, which I think should have been a bit more than actually a retraction with what they went about. But, you know, football is a fabulous sport, and those small parts in my life can't stop me being, or telling you the joy that I've had since I was 15 years old and playing and managing in professional football at 65. So that could never take all that joy away. And those small dark moments, why you're not forgetting, are not the ones that...
Sam, I'm a great conspiracy theorist, and you would describe yourself as a journeyman player. Do you think then there were people in the press who thought, Sam Allardyce, managing England?
Oh, no doubt.
Really?
There's no doubt. There's a few who wouldn't like you or don't think you should get it. There's no doubt about that. I think there's a word my wife calls me, Marmite. You know, some like this and some don't. You know, my wife's a great, is great at opinions and great at understanding and looking at people, and very often far better than me. I don't know whether Ruth's the same, but certainly my wife is. And I think that, you know, that there's lots of people make assumptions of me based on how I come across, but don't really know the real me. But that front is what I think I have to become a successful manager. So there are times I'm outspoken, and there's times when I speak too much and I shouldn't. And often my wife tells me that. But sometimes it's just who I am.
That's why you're in such demand in the game, for your opinions, your ideas, your analysis, your punditry. That's what makes you such a character. And without character, what is this game? Which brings me on to VAR, because does that not simply suck the character out of the game? I thought to myself, VAR would be absolutely brilliant.
Well, I've been pushing it for more than 88 years or so, and by saying that there's certain times in decisions that have to be looked at, because it's really impossible for the pace and the speed of the game today for three officials on the pitch.
What have they got to do with it now, Sam? I mean, surely it's taking the energy, the goal celebration. I mean, personally, I think they have to include the fans. They have to do it more like rugby. What are they frightened about showing? Why does the big screen scare them? The referee surely now has to go to the sideline to review their own decisions. Otherwise, everyone just sits there for 3 minutes waiting in the dark for what's happening.
Well, if you went back before VAR, then you would walk out after a game as a manager, and but more often than not, it would be the first question would, what do you think about that referee's decision? Whether that be on camera or whether that be in the press or on radio. Because a vulnerable time of the game is straight after the game as a manager, particularly if you've been hard done by that decision, yeah, and you've lost. And so you have to be very careful about that answer. So I thought VAR, when that came in, would take that question away, yeah, and we might talk about why would you think the game went? Do you think you? What about your substitutions? Or, you know, what about certain players? Didn't you play well? Or, but now the first question is, well, what do you think of that VAR decision? You know, and that takes up your time, and you don't get to talk about the game. You don't get to talk about what's happened in the game or what's not happened in the game. So there's still quite a way to go to sit down and say, how do we modify this to make it better for everybody and still keep the decision-making process so we've got it right more than we get it wrong. The VAR is a tool, but the human being is the man that looks at it and makes the decision. And there seems to be where the problem lies. But the other side of it, Eamon, is this. If we go along now and say that we're going to tell referees that we need to go and look at the monitor, you know as well as I do what will happen. That every referee will start going, I hope not, but every referee will start going, and they'll overcompensate again because they're in a very difficult position. They have a very, very difficult job. And then they'll be worried about what people will say about them or their bosses will, by saying, well, why didn't you go and look at the monitor? So they'll go and look at the monitor just in case, and they need really no need to. And I think that's where, you know, with the cricket, I was at the test match in, you know, Australia, and, you know, is he out or is he not out? Is he out? Isn't he out? You know, and the crowd go, ooh, you know, whatever, which way. So get them involved, and they'll wait that little bit longer, but a bit of work to do, definitely.
Okay, Paul Pogba, is there a bit of work to do there? Buy or sell, do you take the money or not?
Well, you sell, you're in the same market as you've sold from, you know, and without...
But if the player doesn't seem to want to be there, whatever his talent is...
Whatever his talent, but, I mean, if he's... One of the things about is about... I still don't think, and I think this in general, I still don't think as managers we can get too softened. But with the tread over the line, you've got to discipline them, mate.
What about their agents? What about their human rights?
And that's why I'm glad there's a director of football, and I'm glad that I'm not dealing with them anymore, because that's not what I want to do, like I mean. But I think that, you know, somewhere along the line, you know, if he wants to get away, then if the agent's working to get him away at the right price for the club, is going to, is a big problem for Manchester United. Whereas if the player plays way above himself and gives and delivers to Manchester United like Ronaldo did.
He played an extra year for Fergie, everybody won.
Whereas if it's in the reverse at the moment, he's like, keep saying this, and Manchester United will get fed up with you and sell you at the right price for the club who's buying it, then that is very difficult for Man United to overcome.
Okay, you now manage a group of young men leading a life completely different to yours as a player in the 70s. How do you guide them? How do you lead them? Do you have to be like a parent to them?
It has changed dramatically, I think, in the last... but life has changed dramatically in terms of how much more lenient we are across the world, certainly in our country. But there's always and never will be where discipline is not a major factor in how successful you're going to be. Because if you don't have anything, you won't win anything.
But if a player turns up in a gold Rolls Royce to training, at the training ground, is that a disciplinary thing? And if you wanted to do something about it, could you actually? What would you do about it?
I'd ask him if I could have a drive. Could I have a go? So, you know... I mean, Monday I might be able to afford to buy one, so can I give it a go? Give us a go, you know what I mean? So I think that...
It doesn't breathe discontent or anything?
Not really. I mean, they have more than one, Eamon, now.
Yes.
That you look across the board, and anybody that's successful today, that one of the car that they drive is very, very important to them. And, of course, it's It's the social media side, of course, that we... How popular everybody needs to be on social media today. Our private lives don't become our own private lives anymore, which is what the young ones are obviously entitled to do.
Do you do a bit of Instagram?
Tried a bit of that for about 2 months. Because I can do better things in my time than, you know, looking at words on my phone, like you mean. So, but we do all, even me, you do, we all have got addicted to our phones. Where's my keys? Where's my phone?
In your day, was there music in the dressing room? I mean, as a player, what kind of music do you remember in the dressing room?
Well, I was a Motown man, like you mean, so I just sang it with Motown on in my time, in the early days, like you mean. So that, the you know, but in the early days, there wouldn't be a lot of music, you know, and there would only be a radio, you know what I mean? So that wasn't... And in the early days, and people might not believe this, you used to sit in the dressing room and wander around to do a few stretches, rub a bit of deep heat on your leg, and run out at 5 to 3 and do run up and down the pitch a few times, kick off and off you go. And then when you're finished, I mean, our squads used to be about 16 then. So the captain of Bolt Wanderers at the time would give the captain of whoever were playing 16 tickets to go in the players' lounge, have a couple of pints before they got on the coach. We'd have a couple of pints before we went off. I mean, you know, it was from a social and active point of view, we were great in terms of I kicked him, he had to go up me. We got in the players' lounge after, I'll get you back when you're down at our place. And you got all that sort of banter that went on then, like you mean. And then a couple of pints in between, and then got the coach, drive home. We would probably maybe go out and carry on, you know.
Right, here's something I want to ask you. You may have called it banter in your days, and as a fan today, I have a bit of a problem when players are all hugging and kissing each other on the pitch, when they're going on, coming off, they're there in the tunnel, they're doing all that sort of thing. They're covering their mouths so no one can see what they're saying. You see, I, and I'm sure I speak for a lot of fans, I don't want my team to be the best of buddies with the opposition. I want them to be distant. I want them to feel the pain and the competitiveness that we're all feeling. So what do you think now in this more snowflake society where everybody, has to love each other?
Snowflake's a good word, actually. Snowflake society's the rule. I mean, I'm glad to see they've stopped swapping all them shirts. Well, certainly at Bolt Wanderers when I were there, said, look, you know, if you keep something, we're going to run out of shirts, because you only had certain allocations per year from your kit company, like you mean. So I said, don't give your shirts away. You know what I mean? And certainly don't give one away on the pitch at half time, which happened to me with, I think Juffy did it once, and that he got, it cost him a few bob, that did. So, but that's stopped now. But it just the way it moves on, like the headphones and the track suits instead of the suits and ties. The way that you prepare them and the way that they expect you to prepare them now is what they demand, and you then demand the best out of them. So what we can't give you anymore, lads, and you're letting us down, you're letting yourself down by your performance, so stop it, because you've got an opportunity to kick on and get better in the environment you're working in. But it's not for me to continue to let you off. I'm going to drop you, I'm going to leave you out the side, and I'm going to tell you why I leave you out the side, because it's very difficult for a player to argue with you when you leave him out there, because you've already done your research, you've already seen that a diminishing performance. So you ask, why is your performance slipping? And normally, and a lot of the time, it can be very difficult to find out why, and sometimes, and many times, it's not happening in the football club, it's happening away from it. Something's happened that they haven't asked for help in some way or other, no matter what it is, and that has affected the performance. And if you can help them sort that out, then you get them back and get them back again. But, it's also about them, they don't actually criticise each other enough. Like we did in our days, where, you know, if I wasn't doing my bit, it'd be the captain and one or two players were telling me, what, you know, come on, you know, sort yourself out, like you mean, you know, what are you doing today, like you mean. And I think that seems to be they seem to be sort of very tentative in terms of criticising themselves and sorting themselves out on the pitch. So, you know, I'd like to see a bit more of that, a bit more self-management.
It's interesting times. Fergie once said to me that he's glad he's retired because he doesn't think he could manage nowadays some of the ways that he was used to. And I suppose we're talking about hairdryer treatment. That would be so much less acceptable these days?
Well, definitely less acceptable. That's exactly it. But it warrants a place sometimes, but not very often.
Let me ask you this. Club versus country. You've been on both sides of this situation, and I think a lot of fans, it's a difficult one, but I think a lot of fans see international football as a little bit of an inconvenience to the league.
It pains me somewhat still because I was in that position as England manager, but I saw a crop of good players, you know, and I saw an opportunity where I thought that they would get better, and that was certainly proven by what Gareth achieved in the World Cup, and can they go beyond that now? But it's the demand of those players from the football club and from England that is the concern. But unfortunately, because the player asks for so much money, the demand on that player becomes more and more demanding. And I'm not so sure that the bodies and the minds can cope with it. For instance, they would be only getting 3 weeks off a year.
Yeah.
Because if they're a good player, they'll have played for the club in the FA Cup, in the Cup final. They'll have played in the Champions League. They'll have played at international level. And then they'll get 3 weeks off. And then the club will go, well, we've got a tournament in China. Yeah. We've got a tournament in Australia. We've got a tournament in the USA. It's going to net us 10, 15 million quid. We're going to have to do that because you've asked for so much money. So off you go. So where does a player... Not this is not just physically, this is mentally. Get a rest. And that is one of the problems that the game is going to suffer with.
And there will be casualties with that. I'm thinking about the Carabao Cup, the League Cup, and you can see how teams and managers obviously go, the Premier League's more important for me to survive in, or I've got European football during the week. For me, surely the League Cup eventually has got to be a casualty when it comes to the bigger teams.
We're very fortunate this year that the Premier League particularly turned down an increase in the Champions League. Yeah. International level, they've increased the European Championships to more games. They'll eventually want to increase the World Cup again. So where does it all stop? Because all those associations want to make money. So the FIFA want to make money, so let's do more games.
Now, this is what I was trying to say. Managers don't want their players coming back crocked. Fans don't want their players coming back crocked. I just wonder if international football is on the wane compared to club football.
Well, the Premier League has been far greater than our international football for a while because of its global success. But you have to bear in mind, it's brought a huge amount of jealousy from all the other clubs, all the other countries. Well, would you not, the Bundesliga not be the Premier League? Would they not? Would La Liga not like to be the Premier League? You know, would the Italian Serie A not like to be? They're all extremely jealous of what has been achieved by what the Premier League has actually globally delivered. And you can't... I think we knock it too much, personally, sometimes. Well, I travel all over the world, Eamon. I was recently in Phuket in South Africa, just last week. I'm astonished at the amount of pictures I've taken. And I haven't been involved in football for 18 months now. You know, and they're going around, oh, Big Sam, give us a picture, you know what I mean? And Phuket was again, and this wasn't English people, these were the workers in the hotel and the local people, and that's how much it's globally enriched our game by you as a person, as a manager, or as a player, are globally known throughout the world of football.
Which is ironic, because I think without certain weaknesses that we all would have known from the olden days, the old First Division, maybe the game's a bit more predictable. It's a bit less end-to-end. It's a bit less 4-3 in terms of score. Maybe it's a bit less of what people like you and me were brought up on.
Sometimes the game has tried to be evolved too much for me, because there's this There's this overwhelming factor of playing open, attractive football now. And it's overwhelming for every manager to think that he can go into a football club and not play open, attractive football. And that is actually a nonsense. Because you can only play to the skills and the level of skills of your players. Because this is changing the rule, and this is why I want somebody to do the statistics on that. They thought changing the rule by a goalkeeper passing to a centre-half or anybody in his own box was going to enhance the game. It's actually detracted from it massively. So more goals will be scored against the team who play the ball into the centre-half in his box. There'll be more goals scored against them because of that than at the other end. And I bet at the end of the season, when you do the stats, that twice as many goals has been scored from the mistake made by that position than there will be scored at that end. Now, that is not good, and that's not open, attractive football. That's just stupidity.
Whatever happened to 4-4-2?
Coaches from abroad of beliefs, Dutch and Italian, Spanish, Portuguese.
Mourinho.
Their belief is midfield area and in possession of the ball. But there's always one thing that's taught you, and it's taught about possession and progression. And it's how quick you can move the ball from A to B through the lines, into through midfield and back out again. And I think what's got caught up with now is that it's all about talking about we've had 860 passes. But if you look at how many times you're in the opposition's box, it's four. We've only gone in the opposition's final third four times now. Our fans don't want that. Our fans want action in that box, and they want us to defend the action in this box to stop the opposition scoring. So actually goal mouth action has actually, I think, reduced because of that. So there is a balance between doing that and doing it too much rather than doing what the best teams do. And Manchester City move the ball that quickly and have the best possession that they're and Liverpool at the moment are the two best teams at it, and that is exciting. But some of the other sides that keep it and the fans are waiting for some action in the opposition box and don't get enough action.
Thank you, Sam. Thank you. It's been great having a pint with you. Cheers.
Try this now.
Thank you. You know, I think from hearing his talk, a lot of people hear your passion, they hear your expertise, they respect your deep knowledge. So tell me this, you're in your mid-60s, and I don't know if there's another club and you are not, but if you retired next week, how would you like people, fans, to remember Big Sam, Bionic Man?
I think that what I have to say is this. I was 15 when I left school, and I've never worked. That's how much I've enjoyed it. So I've been so fortunate compared to most people that my worst years were at school, and since I left school I've had the greatest time of my life, and I think that being a professional footballer right the way through to 38 and playing in all four divisions, being a manager having managed in all four divisions, and ultimately whatever anybody says, I got the best job ever, so I achieved my ultimate goal, which was to be the England manager. But I've enjoyed myself so much that whatever anybody says about me, or whether they lock me or whether they like me, like I said, the missus calls me Marmite. My life, and I've dedicated my life back to football because it's gave me so much. It gave my family so much. So it's a beautiful game, and it will always be a beautiful game in my eyes.
Well, you keep enjoying yourself, mate. Absolute pleasure. Thank you. And that was my chat with Sam Allardyce. I hope you enjoyed it. Please remember to subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts so you get them as soon as they come out. This podcast was produced by 1129 Media.